Hey, is there a show next week? It's the week of Thanksgiving.
Oh, I should have said that. My bad.
Oh, there isn't? Oh, my God. I always try to remember to ask you at the beginning of the show. And 99 times of 100, you say, well, as far as I know, there is. Or, oh, well, no problem. I'm like, well, you're the only one who ever cancels. So so you're saying there is no show next week?
I won't be, at home.
Well, that's good. Be safe, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Maybe we should put this at the beginning of the show.
That's right, and then we'll have to somehow indicate fade out and come back into the top of the show after the end of the show begins at the. My God, this is like an episode of Tenet.
You know we do have music for that, right?
Oh, okay. Play some music.
For the week of November 15th, 2020, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 518, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And at Tower Records, I'm Michael Giltz. Tower Records has opened up again. I'm so excited. I'm waiting out. I'm first in line, to be honest with you.
So, Michael,
a little, I don't know. Hey, is that Jeff Bridges?
Yeah, you know, Michael, I have some good news and some bad news.
Okay.
You may have been hit on the head and fallen asleep for about 25 years. You either that or you have a time machine. So congratulations on that. Apparently you got that working. But well, Tower Records no longer exists. It went out of business, I want to say, in the mid-2000s.
It's opening back up. I got a link. I have a link in our show notes. Tower Records is reopening. Oh, online.
Yeah.
Online. Oh.
Okay.
That wasn't Jeff Bridges. That was Kevin Flynn of Tron. That's who it is, because I'm apparently at TowerRecords.com. Because believe me, I'm looking at the marquee. So yes, Tower Records is not opening up physically, but they are opening up digitally. They wanted to reopen physically. They were going to do pop-up stores. I'm sure right about now during the holidays is when they plan to do that. But the pandemic has made that difficult. So for now, Tower Records is open up online. You know, you can buy your LPs and, you know, support your local independent record store owner. But if you're not finding it there and you need to look for something else, TowerRecords.com, I love the place. It was a store that I just lived in practically. I might as well put my bed in there. So it's cool to see that logo back up and them online and maybe popping back into the stores. But you know what? No matter where you are, I bet you've got an independent record store just waiting for you. So if you need that indoor experience, keep your mask on and enjoy the shopping.
I don't understand. I mean, why would they? I mean, are people still buying records? I like buying CDs, but I know not a lot of people do.
Vinyl and even cassettes are a niche enterprise. It's for audiophiles. It's for people who want to have that physical thing. It's nowhere near what digital is. But you can also buy digital downloads of albums at TowerRecords.com, along with, of course, cassettes, CDs, and vinyl. So it's for the real hardcore music collector, but they're still out there, and it's, you know, a good business. It's not a billion-dollar business, but it's big. You know, hundreds of millions of dollars can be made.
Okay, so I'm looking here, Fleetwood Mac rumors, $20.48, and it is a vinyl LP. Okay, so and if I were to go to Amazon, how much is rumors? Probably not that much.
There would be lots of different types of vinyl offerings. There'd be used. There would be a classic original version. There's probably a reissue is what you're looking at on, you know, it's fancy gram, heavy gram, you know, to make it nicer, but not always so. So, you know, sometimes you're better off getting that classic earlier version in a nice mint condition than paying $30 for the new reissue, because they're not always doing a good job on the sound with those reissues. So buyer beware when it comes to vinyl.
Yeah, you know, and the funny thing is when I type in Fleetwood Mac rumors on Amazon, it immediately autofills vinyl. Like it doesn't,
because people are not buying, they're not buying CDs and cassettes.
Yeah, I mean, so they must pretty much say, you know what, you're looking for this. You're either looking for it to stream, which we're gonna shoot you on over to Amazon Music, or you want to buy vinyl because heaven knows you sure don't want to buy a CD, do you? I mean, come on, you want a wax cylinder as well? Come on.
Right. And thank you for going right to Amazon and thus destroying our economy.
I just wanted to see the price differential.
Sure, sure. But that's, you know, you want to support good jobs, head to your local record store. But if you want to support our podcast, keep listening. What are we going to talk about this week?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we are digesting everything we learned and didn't learn from Disney's earnings call. That seemed to be all the rage last week. That's what all the kids were talking about. They gave us
kids.
Yeah, exactly. They gave us lots of information, lots of numbers, but not the numbers we really wanted. Plus, another big movie goes to streaming, at least overseas. How is that for a teaser? We're not going to give you like really what we're talking about, but you got to listen to find out.
You got to wait to get the news of the world. You have to wait to get the news of the world.
Well, we'll tell you, maybe this will help kind of propel people towards the end of our show, which will be in about 3 or 4 days from now, you know, by the time we're done recording. On Inside Baseball, in fact, we'll talk about cord cutting. It's real. It's happening, but it's not quite what you think. We'll explain. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll discuss some of the week's top headlines or the weekend's top headlines. So there's a little teaser for you. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's box office. And actually, there's some good news.
Well, there's always a little bit of good news. Japan and China have the lights back on, that's for sure. We're looking at the box office around the world for the week ending Sunday, November 15th. We're pulling information from everywhere we can. ComScore, we miss ya. And the number one movie around the world is, in fact, a Japanese film, Demon Slayer, the movie, Infinity Train. That made another $26 million this week. It's at $225 million worldwide. That is a huge success story. Also, a good strong hit is The Sacrifice, a Chinese drama set during the Korean conflict. That made $15 million. It's at $140 million worldwide.
I love the Elton John, the hit single that recorded. He recorded for that movie.
It was very touching over the scenes of battle with Elton singing away. It was very, very touching.
Yeah.
Number three is a U.S. film being issued in China for the first time. It's Hellboy, the 2019 remake. That made $10 million in its opening week. That's probably better than it did in the U.S. on its opening week because it didn't make a lot of money. That brings its worldwide total to $55 million. Still in China, My People, My Homeland, that patriotic documentary omnibus, still chugging along. Another $6 million. That's at $420 million worldwide. Is that the highest grossing documentary film of all time? It might well be. $420 million. Maybe the original was. That's got to be up there. Certainly. I mean, Fahrenheit 9/11.
But is it a documentary? Is it a documentary or is it?
It is. It is indeed.
Okay. All right.
It is a documentary. Right below that is The Paw Patrol, Mighty Pups, the movie. This is a film from a year or two ago, also released in China. It made $5 million. This week it's at $12 million and counting. More movies from the past getting a new life in China. Digimon Adventure, Last Evolution. This is a Japanese animated film. It made $4 million this week. It's at $22 million worldwide. It has made most of that money in China. Why? Why would this film make so little in Japan and so much in China? If anyone knows, tell us.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, we're on Twitter. @showbizsandbox is our handle. Or we're on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox.
Showbiz Sandbox. Yes, Vince Vaughn, actor Vince Vaughn. You remember when David Letterman had a heart attack and had to be out for a little bit?
Yeah, and Vince Vaughn stepped in. He did a good job, actually. Yeah,
he did a great job. You know, a lot of people guest hosted. He did it one night, and it was like he was born to be behind the desk. It was scary how good he was. Well, now he's just being plain old scary. He's the star of a new film called Freaky, in which a teenage girl and a serial killer switch bodies. Isn't that creepy? I guess there's a lot of humor in it, too. I don't know that, but that's my sort of guess. That made $4 million on its opening week here in the U.S. Then there's another new movie. This opened up in China. Didn't do so well. It's called Find Your Voice. It's a Chinese drama about ne'er-do-well kids who are forced to go into a classical choir. You know, you're a delinquent. You should be singing arias. I'm not quite sure how that works. But anyway, a really famous conductor comes back from the U.S. to Hong Kong to train them and make them good. I'm guessing they win the big competition. I don't know that, but that's my guess. It made $3 million on its opening week. Maybe it was a preview. Maybe it's only on limited screens. Does China do limited openings?
I don't know. I think they must.
Everybody must, I guess, a little bit. So I know they do sneak previews every once in a while. Maybe that's a sneak preview. Or maybe people just turned down the movie and didn't find it very good. But it made $3 million on its opening week. Then we got a bunch of movies with $3 million and less. We're glad that they're making a little bit of money. But you can see we're in the top 10 and we're down to $3 million, $2 million, $1 million. So not a lot of money being made beyond the big hits. Coffee or Tea, that Chinese comedy about three pals, that's about to hit $50 million. Here in the U.S., Let Him Go, a drama starring Kevin Costner. In its second week, it's totaled $7 million so far worldwide. Back to the Wharf, a Chinese crime thriller, that's at $10 million. Honest Thief with Liam Neeson, that's at $23 million. Tenet is still moving along. That's at $353 million worldwide.
Do you know I still haven't seen that movie? Not to interrupt you, but I still have not seen that movie. I will never see this movie in a movie theater.
Well, that would be a shame. It'll be less fun at home, that's for sure. Did you see Come Play, the horror flick? I bet you didn't.
No, I have not.
That's at $8 million this week worldwide. Leap, starring Gong Li, still making money, $126 million. And Harrison Ford, his movie, The Call of the Wild, didn't do that well, but it has opened up in China to a very modest $1 million. So even if people are ready to go back to movies, you still have to give them the movies they want.
Yes, and we want movies, except they're not actually being released in movie theaters. Although Freaky was, and it was released on, you know, $3 million in the U.S., and people are at 3.7, something like that. People are over the moon. They're like, wow, it did great.
Well, you know, that's the way they should be. They should, you know, alter their expectations. They should recognize the place we're in. Half the theaters are closed in North America. The biggest markets are closed or way pushed back. The percentages available for people to go buy tickets in other markets are much lower, you know, 30% capacity, 25% capacity. So yeah, you know, and things are just getting worse here. New York State, they've got a 10 p.m. curfew for bars and restaurants. Hope for cinemas reopening in the city, that is dimming. And there are every day, you know, we don't go through it, but every day it seems like there's some film or TV production that is shut down for a week or 2 weeks because of COVID. You know, there's a lot of things filming, so it's a good sign that, you know, they're not all shutting down, but it is a constant problem and adding to the expense for sure. There's a lot of money that goes into making these shows, and when you have to shut down for 2 weeks, that certainly doesn't help. But we know not everything is filmed is going to be coming out right now. Other things are being delayed. We've got a new film starring Tom Hanks. Earlier this year, his movie went to Apple TV. Now he's got a movie called News of the World, based on a very good novel by author Paulette Giles. It's a sort of a period Western, and he's sort of a guy who goes around town to town telling people the news. He reads out from the newspaper and almost sort of performs the news that he's heard from around the country. He's just sort of the crier, the town crier, but he goes from town to town in the Old West, and he's asked by somebody to deliver a child or something, and they bond, of course. But it's a very good book, very well reviewed. That film, News of the World, it's from Universal, and it is going to Netflix for international distribution.
So basically, Universal wanted to try and recapture its money. They basically were like, well, our budget is X. We can get X from Netflix. Let's sell it to Netflix for international. We will maybe release it in movie theaters over here.
Well, they will here for, of course, Oscar potential, though they could have released it direct to streaming because it was intended for theater. There's no question about that. And also, they know if they only get in AMC theaters after 17 days, they can go to video on demand anyway. So,
which is, I think, what they're doing with Freaky, by the way.
Right, but why in God's name are they not letting anybody show it who can show it? You know, I just don't understand it. We feel this is the perfect type of movie. It wouldn't matter if it opened up 3 months later or 5 months later in some territory. Show it where you can. Let people see it. If you then want to go to streaming, you haven't hurt the movie. And you're giving theaters a desperately needed lifeline. What's the harm in releasing? And the money you spend to promote the movie will make the movie more visible for when it goes to video on demand. And it will, of course, keep people in mind, oh yes, movie going. I like movie going. I want to go movie going. It's a big problem.
You know what? I just want to get out of the house, okay?
Well, lots changing, you know, because of all what's going on. We know that studios may not report their grosses regularly anymore. You know, they've been talking about that for weeks, that they played games with Tenet and some other movies, and now we're thinking they might just be holding back information from now on. Maybe
they're going full Netflix on us.
That's right. But that's, you know, that's one of the best PR things that they have, isn't it?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think that I loved, you're talking about the Pamela McClintock piece in The Hollywood Reporter, where, you know.
No, I'm not. but thank you for telling me.
Yeah, no, that she did a piece on it where Tom Rothman said, yeah, you know, it's good and it's also bad. One of the things they're kind of pointing to is, you know, hey, you're basically letting your competitors know all of your competitive data. And maybe we should be keeping this a little bit closer to the vest.
The data isn't that broken down, right? It's just grosses.
No, gosh, no.
I know. But in terms of what they want to promote, you know, we don't need, if nobody cares if they want to get tight-fisted with each other. That agreement has been going on for years that basically it's all open books in terms of theaters and where what grossed what where. But in terms of the public, I think they're making a mistake if they hold back the big numbers and just don't even tell us, you know, only hold back information, only provide it when it's good and positive. Don't just say every week, here's what came out, here's what they made. That's all we want. That's all the public wants. I understand that in industry stuff, but I'm just saying a movie opens up, it makes $32 million worldwide. People should know that. That's a very different issue from whether you want them to know what it made in Paloma, you know, or Oklahoma or whatever. No.
Whereas now part of the argument is, well, maybe the movie should just, you know, have a little breathing room and be good and let word of mouth.
No. That's the best PR that they have. A successful movie with good word of mouth and PR. If you only start releasing it when that information, when a movie succeeds, people are just going to stop paying attention. They're like, never mind. You know, if you're not going to use that every week, it's a huge marketing tool. It's a huge positive for the industry to talk about how much movies are out there, how much they're making, what they're doing. I think it's a big mistake to take away one of the best marketing tools they've had for the last 30 years. The idea, well, it'd be great. We'll just let people chat about it online, you know.
I would say read Pamela McClintock's piece. It's actually kind of interesting. Box office reporting may be forever changed due to pandemic. That's
and
the,
so
the
may
headline.
Broadway. And so may Broadway. Broadway looks like they may follow suit. Next year, if there's a partial season, they've already said they're not going to release weekly box office grosses. Why it being a partial season or not makes any difference for the weekly grosses, I don't know. But I think on Broadway, it's far less important for people.
I mean, there's one, you know, house, right? I mean,
well, no, I'm just saying not the industry. I mean, for consumers, people do not track Broadway grosses the way we do.
No, and
so
not at all.
It is not the marketing tool that it could be. And should be.
No, I mean, they track whether it's popular or not, you know, are people talking about it?
In a vague general sense, right.
Yeah.
So I think that's not as important, though. I think, again, it's a big shame because I think it's great for the industry. I think that transparency is really important and really good. And I don't like it. But Broadway is still there. They're hoping to open up next fall. Some shows think they're going to open up next summer. Some shows have already rebooked into new houses. But we know they're going to be performing soon. Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. Broadway will be doing their performances every year at the Thanksgiving Day Parade, sponsored by Macy's. Broadway shows are part of the floats and all the whole parade. And they stop and they perform their big number or medley in front of the cameras and they move on. It's very exciting. And it's great PR. Why give it up? So even though there won't be a parade, even though the parade is only going to go one block from here to here in front of the cameras, I guess you stand around the corner and go, yay, you know, and there will be no crowd. So nonetheless, they're going to do the whole parade for the cameras on one single block without a crowd and with Broadway.
Are they going to do balloons?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're going to have the whole shebang, just no crowds and no parade.
Because, you know, the balloons itself, you need a lot of people to do those balloons.
Well, you need a team, and I'm sure they're outdoors, and they'll be properly masked, and I assume they'll be doing everything they can to make it safe, and if they couldn't do it safe, I would hope they wouldn't do it. So, you know, we have to do that. So that Broadway's getting that little goose, reminding people that Broadway's out there, and it's getting to be a real problem. People are now losing their health insurance because they're not performing. At some point, you know, the shows can offer to pay your health insurance while you're down, but they can't do it if you don't qualify for the health insurance when you're not an actual performer on the stage. So that's becoming a big problem because everybody's hitting that wall right about now.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting. Look, I'm a big fan of the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. I was one of their official photographers for years. Back in the 80s. And by the way, speaking of the 80s, you know that little joke I made? With the Elton John joke that I made?
Uh-huh.
That song is 31 years old. Do you think anybody got that joke about Sacrifice?
It's a classic by Elton John. It's okay. If they didn't, they'll know to look it up.
Okay.
There's no good segue to this. It's sad news. It's unpleasant news. Jeffrey Toobin has been fired from The New Yorker for masturbating during a business Zoom call and accidentally exposing himself. You really shouldn't do that. So yeah. He has gone from the New Yorker after many decades of service. I had a weird, there's a weird gender disparity here where men are like, well, you know, he didn't mean to. And women are like, why are you trying to defend someone who was masturbating during a business call and got unintentionally caught? Well, it was just, yeah. It was a business call.
It was over, and he thought he had turned the camera
off. No. They were. Maybe he was just getting going, but nonetheless, it was during a business call. Everybody was there. He screwed up, but no, it was during a business call. Of course it was. But that's why they were on the Zoom chat together. Right. Yeah. So again, men, like you just said, defending him. Go, well,
I'm not defending him. No, I'm saying,
You know, they had finished their business and it was just chit chat at that point. Still inappropriate.
No, I think what I'm saying is he needs to learn how to use the technology. I think he thought he undid, like, I'm hanging up now, and he hadn't actually hung up. Oops.
I have not heard a breakdown of what exactly happened, but that's not my impression that he thought.
He said that.
Yes, but that's not what other people said.
Oh, okay.
There's no proof that he wasn't masturbating during the entire, wait, the call ends and 2 seconds later he's masturbating? No. You know, no. So anyway.
Hey, this is a children's show.
Is it really? Well, you know who knows children's shows better than anyone? Disney. They had a big earnings call. Disney's just dominating the industry. 40% of box office last year. Massive success in streaming. So if we keep talking about Disney, it's because they are the 800-pound gorilla right now, aren't they?
They really are. I mean, they're still making a lot of money. They're not making as much money as when their parks are open and they're basically charging, you know, everybody $500 for a 16-ounce Coca-Cola. But they're still, you know, they're making money.
So what happened on the earnings call?
Well, they're still talking about how they can't open Disneyland. And they probably, well, now they're definitely saying it's not going to reopen this year. It will be closed until at least January 1st, 2021.
That's 6 weeks away. Of course, it's not opening up.
Right. And to which I would say, hey, you'll be lucky if Disney World is not going to shut down again.
No, yeah, the whole country may have a shutdown again. So they're very angry at Governor Gavin Newsom. They've really gone to town on him. But, you know, they got to worry about the optics, I think, a little bit. It's coming against a backdrop of the pandemic's second or third wave, a record 2,000 people dying a day in one day last week, and talk of another shutdown nationwide to smother the virus. It's starting to not look good when they're complaining that they can't open up. I really do think the answer is not that they should be open up, but that, you know, restaurants and bars and other things are going to need to shut down again.
When you look at the infection rate, okay, when you want to just talk about common sense, all mm-hmm. right, and math, when you look from the time this started, March 13th, all the way to today, the levels of infection, the number of people being infected per day, and I realize the testing, that, you know, there's more testing going on now, and that's a good thing.
Right.
But when you look at, we shut down the economy and the country for like 2-3 months, and I'm not saying we shouldn't have, okay? But the levels were much lower than they are today, and yet we're not shutting down. So I look at this and go, guys, if you shut down when 2 people were being infected, now that 10 people are being infected, hey, what's the difference there? Why aren't you behaving the same way you did six months ago?
They've seen the big price that they paid, but the answer is not to not shut down, but to maybe keep up schools open through eighth grade, that kids perhaps can still go to school safely. That seems to be one thing that we may have learned, not definitively, but they seem to not be spreading it much, and they don't seem to be hotbeds of hot spots of coronavirus spread. But we're not epidemiologists, but we do know it keeps going up. And when they did shut down, you could say, well, it didn't work. Well, we also had a government that was saying, don't bother, yelling and screaming at states to open back up, telling people not to bother wearing a mask. So that message does not help at all.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because in New Mexico, there were some Alamo Drafthouse franchisees, and I think some other theater operators too. Movie theaters never reopened in New Mexico. It was one of the states, along with New York, where no movie theaters were allowed to reopen for a time. And so still to this day, New Mexico has not said movie theaters can open. However, these operators decided they were going to open against the court order, yeah, against state law,
and, or state ruling or state whatever guidance,
and all of these other theater operators, especially ones from Texas, were saying, "Look, in El Paso, you've got the 6-7 intensive care units being put in parking lots in hospitals. Okay, you've got temporary morgues, mobile morgues being set up in El Paso. That's how bad things have gotten in El Paso, which, by the way, borders New Mexico. And you guys think it's a really good idea to be like, you're giving us all a bad name. Like, mm-hmm. you're actually reflecting poorly on us. And we're trying to say that we're responsible. You're not helping.
No.
So other theaters lashed out at them.
Lashed out seems so strong. They said, you know, lashed out makes them sound unhinged and angry. How about admonished them and said, that's correct. Not good. I don't like it when people use those loaded terms to describe people who are doing something reasonable. I understand how it happens, though. Even while we're talking here, another TV show has shut down for 2 weeks. It's the TV series Dear White People. And another streaming bit of news, Michael Bay's pandemic thriller Songbird, that is going straight to premium video on demand. It will not be playing in movie theaters. That joins Universal's News of the World, right? The Tom Hanks film that is also going streaming internationally. And hence my pun on News of the World. So streaming brings us right back to Disney, right? They're angry. They're upset. They say outdoor theme parks can be safe. But not only did they gripe about that, they were also able to beat investor expectations. They crowed about the success of Disney Plus, and they said they would hold back on dividends again so they could invest in content, one of the demands of one of their agitating outside investors. What happened with Disney Plus?
Disney Plus is on my TV. That's what happened to it.
I have it too.
Yeah. By the way, it's also on, okay, so you have it, I have it. It's also on 72,999,998 other people's television. They didn't think they would, their whole goal, Disney's goal was by 2024, we want 60 million subscribers. Well, congratulations. It's not 2024. You did it in 9 months.
That's right. So yeah, they jumped from 60 million in early August. So despite the lockdown ending in a lot of the country, they've still been growing very substantially. In 8 weeks, they increased another 20%. And of course, they just have a new season of The Mandalorian that just hit. They have Soul, the Pixar film, coming Christmas Day. They feel like they've got a winning hand with Disney Plus. They get $6 a month from everybody, right? Is it six or seven? Six.
It's like, yes. Six.
That's one of their big successes. The other one is remaking their animated films, and they got another one, Lilo and Stitch. That Hawaiian.
Can I tell you right now? Don't do this. It's not worth it.
Why do you say that?
Because you know what? Just don't. It's got like these weird creatures in it, and just don't do it. You don't need to do it.
They are clearly running out of their premiere movies, but Lilo and Stitch is a very valuable property. They've had at least 3 direct-to-video sequels. They've had 2 or 3 TV shows, spinoffs around the world. There's a Japanese version, I believe. They've had specials around the world with the character Stitch. So God knows how much they've sold in merchandise. I believe Stitch is very, very popular. The ugly, scary alien, but yet somehow adorable creature. So Lilo and Stitch is a valuable property, no doubt about that. But certainly you're not talking about remaking Snow White in live action. You're talking about Lilo and Stitch. So you know, that's been a big winning hand for Disney the last few years. They're going to be getting down to The Rescuers Down Under and, you know, The Fox and the Hound, which seems ripe for their live action.
What about an American Tale? Is that an American Tale?
That's not
Fievel?
Disney. That's not
I
Disney.
Know, but I'm just pulling. What was animated? Turn it into a live action film.
There's the reason some things are animated, because they work best that way. But they're making money with them. And
The Black Cauldron. Get the Black Cauldron out.
And do it right. That's a very valuable property. I think that's being developed into a TV series. So that's good news as far as investors are concerned, but should also give you pause when you say, wow, Disney can't do any wrong. They're running out of things to remake as live action, that's for sure. And what was
one of the live action remakes was Mulan.
That's right. They gave us all this information, but what information was missing?
Mulan.
Well, they must have talked about it.
What did they talk about in terms of Mulan? Oh, it was a huge hit. Trust me, it was a huge hit. You can just, you know what? Just take my word for it. Mulan was anything but a failure. We are going to do this again. It was so popular.
Here's what Disney CEO.
We just won't tell you how much.
Here's what Bob 2.0, aka Disney CEO Bob Chapek, said about Mulan. Quote, Mulan was anything but a failure, and indicated that Disney would employ a similar strategy with other movies. Quote, we saw enough very positive results to know that we've got something here, he told investors. That's pretty weak tea.
Yeah. And he said he pointed to Torrent Freak. He said, look at the piracy numbers on this alone.
Oh, that's who pointed you to the piracy numbers.
No, no, no. Actually, it was all the European, my European colleagues. Why? Because in Europe, you had to go pay to watch it in a movie theater, which they did. But they also pointed out the theater operators over there, they were like, hey, you know what? Actually, it's being heavily pirated. And it was off the charts, pirating-wise. Now, off the charts is always, you know, relative. But because it there was a digital master, you're basically getting something that you can pirate directly off of your television mm-hmm. rather than having to go to a movie theater with a camera, videotape the screen, sync it up with the audio, make sure that nobody steps in front of the camera while you're recording it. Oh, and by the way, you might get caught. Guess what? This goes right into your home. So piracy, that was a bit of an issue with...
Because it's so easy to do.
It's so easy to do, yeah. That's
so you usually see piracy take off once it hits video on demand, or is it always...
Yeah,
or
yeah,
does it happen when they're in theaters as well?
No, it happens when they're in theaters, but to a much lesser degree. Plus, the quality of those is horrible. You know, you got people standing up and walking in front of the camera. Sometimes the camera's out of focus. Sometimes the camera's too grainy. All of a sudden, the camera is tilted a little bit. Not that I know this from any personal experience, but but you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. So Mulan was probably a big whoop once you get right down to it. Certainly didn't make their money back. People did go see it in theaters where they could, but it only made $70 million worldwide. So not for a movie that cost $200 million and had every reasonable expectation of making at least half a billion and, you know, perhaps Goose merchandise and all that. You have to say it was a disappointment.
Wait, did you just say disappointment?
I did.
Okay, because actually, disappointment was not the word I was looking for there or wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk about the word whoop that you used, because that must be telling me it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Here's our first story. It's about Spotify. Maybe you've heard of it. You know, maybe, yeah. Well, the streaming service Spotify remains on a shopping spree, especially when it comes to the world of podcasts. Why? Because Spotify doesn't pay any royalties when people play podcasts on its service. So they'd much rather Michael listen to Joe Rogan instead of Joe Jackson.
Not happening.
By the way, Michael, I was going to say Joe Jackson's great, by the way. That helps explain, by the way, why Spotify just paid $235 million for the podcast ad platform Megaphone. The company has spent some $800 million on purchases like Anchor FM, Gimlet Media, Parcast. I almost said Paracast. It's Parcast. And that doesn't even include the money it spent on Joe Rogan, who Michael is not going to listen to.
No,
but hey, you know what? Joe, if you are listening to us, will you please give us a plug on your show?
Please,
I mean,
please.
We won't know if you did or not, but if you could, that would be great. Big Deal or Big Whoop.
It's a big deal, I guess, right? They're putting money hand over fist into podcasts. They know they can make a lot more money off the margins on that. So it's money well spent as far as they're concerned. And then they turn around and tell their musical artists, oh, sorry, we can't afford to pay you higher royalties. We're still losing money.
We just spent $300 million. Yeah.
Nice work if you can get it.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe they're being run by Dennis the Menace. Okay. Yeah, Dennis the Menace is getting a reboot as a potential TV series.
Oh, sure,
now,
sure.
Yeah, this time the lovable scamp is, wait, he's 16 years old and getting in trouble with the police.
The police.
Wait, and he lives in the UK?
What?
Wait. And the tone is going to be much darker, more like the UK drama Skins that launched the career of Nicholas Hoult and other young Brit actors. What is going on? Dennis the Menace is the little tyke? Where's Mr. Wilson?
Where's Mr. Wilson?
Yeah, okay, well, before you get confused, if you're in the U.S., we're not talking about that Dennis the Menace. And if you are, you know, in the U.S., you know exactly which Dennis the Menace we're talking about. Apparently, two comic strip characters debuted on the same day in 1951. And both, by the way, were called Dennis the Menace. In the U.S., it was a mischievous but well-meaning kid who tried to help others, but invariably made a big mess, driving his poor neighbor, Mr. Wilson, crazy. In the U.K., Dennis the Menace is... well, to put it mildly, he's kind of a bully, actually. He picks on well-behaved kids and almost never gets his comeuppance. Both proved hugely successful, with the U.S. strip still creating new content 70 years later. In the U.K., their Dennis the Menace helped turbocharge the popularity of Beano magazine, where it appears to this day, becoming the face of Beano pretty soon. The company that owns the rights to Beano is looking to develop a lot of its characters into movies and TV shows and the like, and they're starting with Dennis. So brace yourself for Dennis getting a mugshot and doing drugs. Yikes! Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's a big property. It's been around for decades, of course. Beano comes out every week still, and it includes tons of different strips like Tricky Dicky, Roger the Dodger, Minnie the Minx. That may be a PG-13 movie. They've had 4,000 issues and counting. I don't know if it was their peak, but I think in the 50s, they were selling like 2 million copies a week. Whenever you see like a British book or whatever, kids, every once in a while, there's a reference to Beano, and you're like, what? It's not like Mad Magazine. It's more like a omnibus of a bunch of different content. And it's just been around forever. And kids always got Beano and was always a holiday gift. And you would get a subscription to Beano. So this Dennis the Menace is apparently very, very well known and popular. He's not our Dennis, but it's IP. And that's what people love.
2 million copies a week at one point it used to sell. It's amazing. Speaking of amazing, are you looking forward to hearing some live music again someday soon? Because it would be amazing if we could do that.
Yeah, I would.
Are you? Yeah. Now, is a concert on your to-do list, Michael?
Yes.
Well, if Ticketmaster has its way, you'll be doing that tomorrow, in fact. You will, by the way, be able to go back at some point, as long as you can confirm it's safe for you to be in a crowd, okay? The company is developing an app that can receive medical information from third-party companies. What could possibly go wrong? Now, the reason they're doing this is that, you know, without Ticketmaster getting access to your personal medical records, they can give you a green light to see, say, Reba McEntire in concert. So how does it work? You'll have to sign up for an app and then give a third-party company access to confirm some basic medical info, either proof that you've been vaccinated within 12 months or, you know, of the 12 months of the concert, that is, or proof that you've been tested for COVID-19 within a certain time frame, depending on the state you're in, say within 48 hours. And you thought your phone in a locked bag until the show ended was a pain in the neck. How about this? Big deal or big whoop?
This just seems like a really complicated, bad idea. I'm just listening and going, really? Like, maybe you shouldn't be having a concert if that's what you have to do.
What I would tell Ticketmaster is, hey, you know what? We can't get our kids back to school. So if you think we're doing this to go see Reba McEntire, think again.
Hey, don't pick on Reba. But I'm assuming you would also have to put a mask on. I'm assuming that you would still have to be socially distanced and have a mask on, even if you're doing this. I hope they don't think that they can do this and then say, you're fine. Everybody's fine. Cause that's BS. Getting a test within 48 hours is better than not having been tested negative and within 48 hours, but it doesn't mean you're not positive. It just means, you know, it's good, but it's not like, oh, nothing. There's no problem. Now go right ahead. So this just seems bizarre. And you're going to get all these people to download a third-party app, give them access to your medical information, but you know, not all of it. And then that's going to go to ticket. It's like, I just, no. It just seems like, yeah, sorry, you're going to have to wait longer. That's all.
Well, last week we mentioned that the new video game console from Xbox was hitting stores. Mm-hmm. This week it's Sony's PlayStation, which also has a highly touted new game out called Spider-Man Miles Morales. Xbox was hoping to have a new Halo game, but that hit a major snag. Both machines are getting strong reviews as machines, and everyone loves the fact that they have solid state drives, so games load up fast. Man, remember like Red Dead Redemption 2? It took so long to load. I would like start it, read the Sunday Times, and then come back just as I was finishing the crossword so I could start to play.
You have never played Red Dead Redemption 2.
No, but I have read those words. No, I haven't. Did it take a long time to load?
Apparently.
Oh, okay.
That's what the kids say.
Okay, well, yeah. Anyway, PlayStation has the cool new exclusive titles. Xbox has a very strong catalog people can access for just $10 a month, a la Netflix. So parents looking to indulge kids but not go broke can opt for the cheapest Xbox at $300 and toss in Game Pass for a lot of value, while serious gamers will probably gravitate to PlayStation. Again, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, my answer is $175 billion. That is the amount that was spent on video game software worldwide in 2020. $175 billion. So my answer is, yeah, it's a big deal. There's a lot of money at stake. It's not just these two. It's also mobile gaming and games that were downloaded onto phones, which is huge, of course, in India and China and elsewhere, and also here in the US. So, you know, it is a big deal. Subscriptions are not the pure wave of the future, but certainly Xbox is going there first. Apple is already there with gaming subscriptions. We linked to a New York Times article on the state of gaming and will the gaming bubble bust after the pandemic? You know, in fact, gaming stocks fell once there was news of a potential vaccine. People said, ah, people aren't going to be gaming anymore. But if you look at the long-term trends, gaming has been huge for a long time. And while there was a burst of activity, it's also part of a long upward trend in terms of gaming popularity, branching out to women, branching out to older people, not just people under in their 20s and younger, people in their 30s and 40s. They're not stopping gaming just because they're adults and they have kids. They still like to get in there and play World of Warcraft or jump on the new Halo. So it's a big business. There are two very interesting, distinct approaches. Xbox's approach with the subscription pass and PlayStation saying, no, we are still in the business of selling you a game and getting you to download it. That sounds like the past to me. But when they have the biggest, hottest games, it's still going to work.
Yeah, I guess my question for you was, why did you think that Sony PlayStation is for serious gamers?
Well, because that's what the reviews are saying, because they have they've got the more exclusive titles. They won the last round. They had the best exclusive titles. They crushed Xbox in terms of how many consoles they sold, but both sold a lot. And it looks like this time around, everybody, I've only read three or four different reviews, The Guardian, New York Times, elsewhere. But the consensus again seems to be, you know, they've got lots of cool exclusive games. Xbox is behind on that. They're more appealing to people with the subscription service. Seems to be a more inexpensive long-term trend that works really well because those older games look better. They're sort of upgraded a little bit in terms of look thanks to the new console. Basically, you've got Nintendo, Xbox, and Sony PlayStation, putting aside all the mobile gaming. Nintendo's DNA is a toy company, and they make toys, which are really easy to use and fun to play with and simple. Anyone can pick it up and play. Xbox is from a Microsoft, which is a software company. They are used to selling software. They're about the whole, you know, the software experience and the subscription. They want you to pay for, you know, Windows Office every month. They want you to pay for the streaming service every month, just like HBO is doing. Whereas Sony PlayStation is a hardware company. That's their DNA. And they sell hardware. So they have the best hardware. And they want you to buy their PlayStation and say, oh my God, I got to upgrade my TV. I want new speakers. They sell speakers and TVs and consoles. And so that's where their mindset is at. And that's why they are focused like a laser on creating the best gaming experience for people who want to go crazy and buy the most expensive hardware. So you can see their different approaches are sort of part of what those companies are. And Sony seems to be working. They're all succeeding. But Sony is definitely ahead in the console wars. And it doesn't look like Xbox has changed that narrative based on the fact that they have a new one out. It's just as good, but they don't have the games to go with it.
Well, and you know what? Apple is also getting into this game. Although their whole like Apple One thing, like you get a subscription to, I don't play games. You know, that's not,
but it's just free. You get
a knock on anybody that does.
You get 300. But but you don't have to pay for it. Or it's just a freebie. You get 300 magazines and you've saved all your money on $30 a month, but you also get extra storage. You get Apple TV Plus, you get Apple Music, and you got Apple Games. If you don't want to play it, do you feel like you've lost out? You know?
No.
It's really. It's like a channel you don't watch on your cable system. You don't feel annoyed that it's there. Some people do. Well, if it gets too expensive, then they start to say, hey, wait a second. Why am I looking at 500 channels and paying $160 a month? I'd rather just have the 100 channels I watch and only pay $80 a month. But I
hold that thought. Yeah. Hold that thought.
Okay, keep going.
Well, okay. So the Super Bowl problem with booking halftime musical acts is over, okay? After landing on Maroon 5 when other acts of color turned them down, it was possible the NFL was going to be stuck with something like Up With People for years to come. Instead, Shakira and Jennifer Lopez came to the rescue in 2020, and now the 55th Super Bowl halftime guest for 2021 is going to be The Weeknd. The Canadian act has 5 number one hits in the U.S., 12 top 10 hits, and numerous guest appearances with other acts. Are they big enough for the Super Bowl? Is Weeknd big enough? Now, Weeknd is actually just one guy, okay? Yep. Is he big enough for the Super Bowl? Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. The fact that the black eye that they had for a while with the treatment of their players and protest has completely faded away. People want money. They want the audience. They're willing to do it the platform is there. People are going to make use of it. That's a shame to say. But when you're looking at The Weeknd and talking about how big they are, that's why I was pointed out the number one hits and the top 10 hits and that sort of stuff, because that stuff is old news. That stuff is not how you do metrics on who's a big popular act right now. If you look at them and their streaming, they are one of the most streamed albums of 2020 with their new album After Hours. Their singles, right. I Feel It Coming with Daft Punk, almost a billion views, 750 million views. You have Blinding Lights, Call Out My Name, at 600 million plus views. The Secrets, Pray For Me with Kendrick Lamar, all have like hundreds of millions of views. You know, Blinding Lights was number one on the R&B
charts. And this
charts.
Is just on YouTube. Right. This is just on YouTube. Yeah.
For 34 weeks. You know, this is an act with the huge streaming numbers to show they are one of the biggest acts in the world right now. And they've got enough hits to fill up a halftime show. That's for sure. He also says stuff about and ho, you know, that like, really? He doesn't strike me as the most family friendly of acts, but we'll see what he does.
You know, I did not know this at the time, but I actually saw The Weeknd perform live at Coachella. I've seen him perform live twice, at Coachella. And in 2012, well, here's the thing. He was all the rage. He was like burning up the music blogs. He was just the buzz of all, like he was the definition of buzz back in 2011, late 2011, early 2012. He was like, his set at Coachella in 2012 was packed. He was on the outdoor stage. You know what I didn't realize?
Mm-hmm.
That was his first time ever performing in the United States. And it was a boring show.
It's hard. It's hard. Boring. If you're not a big live act yet, it's hard to, you know, figure it out. Maybe he's gotten better. It's been 8 years.
And he did much better in 2018, mm-hmm. I think, is when I saw him again at Coachella, and he was much better. He had bigger hits, and he was playing the main stage, and he was the headliner, but still not a very dynamic act. It's just one guy whose voice is phenomenal, and he just walks back and forth with the microphone. Okay.
Well, that was the old criticism of rap and hip hop that they didn't put on good shows. That's long been destroyed. Plenty of acts can put on good shows. I'm not saying The Weeknd will. I've never seen him live or heard any reviews, but you know, those days are like, it doesn't translate. It's just the artist. It's not the genre. That's for sure.
Well, you could say the same thing, by the way, about Tom Petty. It was just him and the boys standing in front of their microphones, playing their guitars.
Except they were really good.
They were really good. And by the way, you know, The Weeknd, he's got some really good songs and he's got a great voice. So, you know, put the two together.
Right. But you've seen him live and you are unimpressed.
Yeah, I've seen him perform on the Grammys to a much better effect, frankly.
Uh-huh.
So maybe he can pull that off.
Well, he'll have the biggest stage in the world to do it. And more Disney news. They've just signed Alec Baldwin and Kelsey Grammer to star in a multi-camera comedy. Those are birds of a feather for sure.
What is going on there? Unbelievable. Well,
he's got what do you mean? He's got a sitcom. What's wrong with that?
Nothing.
Yeah. He's working. Nothing.
He's a former classmate of mine, by the way.
Alec Baldwin?
Yeah.
You're old enough to be a classmate with Alec Baldwin?
Well, okay. So here's the thing. So he had already starred in many movies,
okay,
including Glengarry Glen Ross and The Hunt for Red October and all. When I was graduating from NYU, there, walking in the procession with me, I was like, wait, that's Alec Baldwin. Apparently, he dropped out of NYU when he was a sophomore in the fall semester, went on to become a famous actor, and they gave him a diploma for writing a newspaper. A term paper. He wrote a term paper on acting.
He finished his requirements.
No, he literally just wrote a term. But there was a lot of flack about this at the time. People were like, so we paid 4 years of college.
An honorary degree, people.
Yeah.
Oh, well. That sounds a little inside baseball-y for me, you know, the ins and outs of the alumni. But it must be time for Inside Baseball. That's where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you.
Well, this week, the way this story, and it's, I guess, a number of stories that they're all about cord cutting. So that's how it's going to affect you. You might have more money in your pocketbook if you cut the cord, quote unquote, cut the cord, and instead of paying your cable provider, say, $150, $160. Wait, what month is it? It's going to go up by $3, which is what my cable bill goes up every month, it seems like. You know
that's
what?
That's $36 a year. That's quite a big jump every year.
Yeah, well, it actually goes up about like $10 a year. And I do not know why. I cannot figure it out.
80 cents a month.
Yeah, well, okay, fine. It goes up 80 cents a month. But, you know, more and more people are cutting the cords. I remember when we were on this show, we were talking about how there were like 98, 99 million households that had cable TV. Remember when we talked about that?
Yeah.
Yeah. How many have it now?
We are in, major providers of TV are in 72 million homes, or just 60% of the total.
Right.
That's so a big decline.
30 million. That's like a 30% decline, practically. 28, 30% decline. That's huge. And by the way, what I have learned since then in my rounds and talking to television executives is that by 2024, 2025, the model that is being used for carriage, so when they're saying, okay, well, we're going to have X number of subscribers, the carriage fees we will be collecting, they're already going to a 50 million subscriber base model, meaning they're thinking it's $72 million subscribers right now.
Homes, yeah. And they anticipated dropping by another 22 million homes.
Correct. Mm-hmm. By 2024.
That'd be another 30% drop from where they are today.
And what, you know, if you look at Disney, right, and they're saying like, hey, look, we hit our goal in 9 months. Well, guess what? That success is actually expediting that decline in cable subscriptions.
Right. Let's not get confused here. Right. So this industry likes to talk about people cutting the cord. That used to mean people said, I don't need TV anymore. I'm getting rid of my cable. I don't need it. But that's not what's happening. People are watching as much TV as ever. What's happening is not people aren't cutting the cord. There is simply competition. And now prices are coming down because people have more options for accessing television. It used just to be your cable company, maybe a satellite dish if you could afford it and it was available in your area. And that was it. There was no competition. Now you can get streaming video on demand. You can get over-the-top television services. You can get YouTube to provide you a package of cable channels. You can get your PlayStation to provide you a package of TV channels. You can get Amazon to provide you a package of TV channels. And you can get an a la carte pick of, you know, Disney Plus, ESPN, Hulu, NBC's Peacock, HBO Max, and on, and Netflix, of course, and on and on and on. So what's happening is not cord cutting. Nobody's walking away from TV. They're just choosing one service over another. That's like when they switch from cable to satellite. Now they're switching from cable and satellite to streaming. They're getting it over the top. And that's what's, it's good. It's competition. It means prices are coming down for people. That ain't great for the companies that were in power, but it's good for consumers and it's healthier. And guess what? 80% of homes with pay TV. So now you say, oh, they're only in 72 million homes. Guess what? Almost all of them also subscribe to a streaming service, like, of course, Netflix. So almost everyone getting over-the-top TV service via Amazon, whatever, they're also getting streaming video on demand like HBO Max and Peacock and Netflix. So, you know, it's happening. But there is, those cable companies are waking up to the future. If they don't provide a better service at a lower price, they're going to keep losing people. They don't have to lose them because it's convenient to have your cable and your Wi-Fi and a bunch of 500 channels. Just don't make us pay through the nose for it. But what's happening is people who move, a lot of them are not signing up to pay TV again. When you look at people who have moved in the past year, 40% of them still don't have pay TV 1 year later.
So what you're saying is like if I went to the Box Brothers store, got a whole bunch of cardboard boxes, packed up all my belongings and moved to a new house or a new apartment, one of the things I'm not doing, I'm making sure the heat's on, I'm making sure that the electricity's on, but I'm not calling the cable company and saying, hey, can you install cable so that when I get there? I'm not doing that.
Exactly. You're not. There's good news for over the top. Hulu, Disney's service that has 36 million subscribers, which includes about 4 million people getting Hulu plus a TV package. ESPN Plus is at 10 million. HBO and HBO Max is at 38 million combined. Peacock can be accessed for free. They say they have 22 million users. I guess that's people who have downloaded it. I don't know how many of those are active users, but I know I am one. And Netflix, that's at 195 million subscribers. People now
worldwide. That's worldwide. Worldwide,
yeah.
Yeah.
These are all worldwide as far as I know. And they believe Disney's going to get close to them pretty damn quick.
Well, I think what's interesting is it used to be that I would go into people's home and they'd have TV, you know, like friends and family who aren't very technically savvy. They had their TV and they had their dish or their cable, and that's what they had. That's what they watched. In the past, maybe 2 months, I've been in two other people's homes, okay, to drop off groceries and things like that. Neither of them had cable anymore. They were bragging. Okay, these are people that should not be bragging. These are people that shouldn't, where I'm like, wait, you know what a Fire Stick is? They're like, yeah, got them for every TV I have in the house. What? Like they got Fire Sticks. They plug them into the back of their TVs. They now have the smart TVs. And there's like, I got the YouTube. I got the, so I used to pay $160 a month. Now I'm paying $60. And they're all very happy. They're trying to tell me this, like, hey, I got a secret for you. I can lower your cable bill. Now, guess who knew that this was coming? AT&T. That's why they bought Warner Brothers. Comcast. That's why they bought NBC Universal.
Mm-hmm. And HBO Max has just come to the Fire Stick to Amazon.
Today, literally today.
Yep. They just made that deal, which is not a surprise. But the one thing they still need their cable companies for is broadband. The final thing people need from a cable provider, and or the only reason they haven't cut the cord, is they need broadband. But guess what? During the election, voters in Chicago and Denver both strongly endorsed non-binding resolutions that call for community broadband for all. Treat it like a public utility. Everyone should have access to broadband. We've got a horrible digital divide, which is, we've seen the repercussions when it comes to kids going to school. Tell kids to work from home. Well, if you don't have Wi-Fi and broadband, how? That doesn't work. And by the way, Elon Musk, his company Starlink, they're in beta and users say it's quite robust. That, I guess, is not targeting rural areas to start with, but I hope that they extend it to rural areas because those have never gotten broadband to the level that they need it. Broadband has been another monopoly, just like cable TV, and hundreds of communities have endorsed the move to community broadband. Wi-Fi providers can choose to dramatically increase their performance, decrease their cost, so that the U.S. doesn't have the crappiest internet among major Western countries, which is what we have now. It's the most expensive and the worst performing among major Western countries, or they can keep fighting their losing battle to try to maintain their monopoly and watch it get chipped away and they lose their business entirely. So they have a decision to make. They're already saying we're going to be down to 50 million. You don't have to, but provide a better service at lower cost. You want to provide broadband? Do a much better job and charge less money. You're going to make less money, but you'll still have your business 10 years from now.
Well, you know, you mentioned Starlink. I'm kind of interested to see how that plays out because it's supposed to cover the globe with, you know, internet access. Of course, it's also making it impossible to see the night sky, but that's another story entirely.
Right. This is we pledged a while ago we weren't going to report Netflix's PR stuff when they said, this is the most popular show on, you know, all this stuff with these numbers that are meaningless. You know, somebody watched 10 seconds of a show because it was automatically played and they count that as a view. We're not reporting any of their nonsense anymore. And in terms of covering cord cutting, from here on out, we're just going to say competition, that there's increased competition, not cord cutting, there's just increased competition and consumers are reaping the benefits because that's what this is. This is not people turning their back on TV. People love TV. People can't stop talking about TV. So that's not what it is. They are not saying
TV. I think the reason that people use cord cutting, at least in the industry, is they're trying to say we're going to call this the move away from MVODs, you know, these cable providers and satellite providers. And so when we say cord cutting, it doesn't necessarily mean, like you say, that they're gone forever.
Well, That's exactly what it means to the general public. That's the phrase that they have promulgated to the world and which general magazines and publications use all the time. When they say cord cutting, they mean, I've gotten rid of my cable. I'm not watching TV. You know, that's what it meant. That's what it means still to most people. People are not cutting the cord just because you switch from Spectrum to DirecTV. That's not cord cutting. If you switch to, you know, a satellite service or you switch to it over the top, you're not getting rid of you're not getting rid of anything. Cable companies are not the be all and end all of television. So we're just going to get rid of that phrase because it only applies to one way of delivering television. It's an outmoded way. It's super expensive, a monopoly, and people are sick of it. And so that's why we're not going to say cord cutting. We're just going to say competition.
There's future battle, competition. A future topic that I know we're going to be talking about.
Uh-huh.
Net neutrality. Trust
me. Oh, it's always there, but we're going to have new people in charge of the FEC, right? The FCC.
Correct.
Pi won't still be there.
It depends.
Yeah. Well, there's some things never change. You linked to a great story about Me Too, I think, in our show notes. I don't know if you still have that in there, about a cinematographer who's been abusing women and taking advantage of his position of power. And so we hope you'll link to that because that looked like a really good story. And when we get to our obit section, the same can be said about playwright Israel Horowitz, who died at 81.
Yeah. Okay. So he was kind of a well-known playwright off Broadway and off Broadway. And he did have like one or two Broadway shows, actually. Yeah,
neither of them were very successful. Plays.
Correct. Worked with Al Pacino when Al Pacino wasn't Al Pacino. And he, I guess, toward the end of his career, got into a little bit of a sexual harassment scandal.
Well, the decades of sexual harassment came back to haunt him, I think is the better way to put it. He did work with a lot of great people, Robert Klein, Marsha Mason, Richard Dreyfuss. He enjoyed a couple really big hits. Most of all, Line. This is a play that I have seen forever advertised walking around town off Broadway. I guess it's like people waiting in line, dirt cheap to produce, always new unknown actors in it. And it just ran forever. And I never saw it. It's kind of like the Fantastics. I never saw it when it was off. I don't know why, but it was always there. I took it for granted and I never went. So Line was still playing right up until the pandemic. It's a play about people waiting in line. It originally starred Richard Dreyfuss. It debuted in 1970. It moved to the 13th Street Rep and was still running until the pandemic, the longest running hit in off Broadway history. But his success has been overshadowed in the last few years. I mean, he first came to prominence in terms of his problems of sexual harassment and the abuse that he did in the 1990s. Women came forward to say he sexually harassed and or assaulted them. It caused a scandal and then nothing, because that's what the world was like in the 1990s, which is only 30 years ago, but still might as well have been the dark ages. But with Me Too, it all came back up again. More women came forward, nine of them describing more sexual harassment, assault, and rape, with one woman 16-year-olds at the time of his sexual misconduct. This time, the women were taken more seriously, and Horowitz sadly paid a price. Now he's died at the age of 81, so the success he had overshadowed by the terrible things he did in his private life.
Now, here's a trivia question for you.
Ooh.
Is Israel Horovitz is the father?
Oh, right. Yes, of course. Beastie Boy, Adam Horowitz.
Adam Horowitz, right. Yeah.
Who is the Ad Rock, right?
I believe so. Yeah.
So nobody has a bad thing to say about actor Sumitra Chatterjee, who died at 85. He's an Indian film star, not a Bollywood star, really a Bengali star. He stayed focused on that. He did not turn to Bollywood. He really embraced his identity on film, stage, and in a lot of writing, poetry, essays, plays, and more. Sadly, he died from complications related to COVID-19, like too many others. And he was a protege of director Satyajit Ray, one of the great directors of all time. And in fact, his film debut was in the third part of the Apu trilogy. The lessest of the three, The World of Apu, but still a very good film in the Apu trilogy. If you've never seen Patha Panchali, for the love of God, go see that movie right now. He started.
That is a great movie. It is a fantastic movie.
Oh, it's a fantastic film. 14 films by Satyajit Ray in all starred Chatterjee, and he really branched out into a lot of other areas, ended up making 300 films, writing plays, performing on stage, did a great King Lear, apparently, directing, writing poetry, essays, and more. So a rich, wonderful career for Sumitra Chatterjee.
I'm just glad that, you were the one who had to pronounce his name, actually.
Oh, we've got a letter to the editor. Oh, what's going on? Cool. I didn't know that.
Joe Gaze, longtime listener, and he writes in every now and again. He congratulated us on our 500th episode a few months back. And apparently, Michael, you've got some competition. He writes, and he wrote to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. He writes, "Hello, Sperling." He's not even addressing you anymore.
No.
Okay, Michael. He says, "Since Michael is on his way out to host Jeopardy, I would like to apply for his job."
Oh,
I have listened. That's true. He says, "I have listened to Showbiz Sandbox for a long time. I know you need to keep up with the showbiz news. Keep Sperling moving when his dad jokes don't land, and let slip my political point of view when I can't seem to help it." So Joe Gaze from Wilmington, Delaware, is going to once you land that job over as the host of Jeopardy. We thankfully don't have to look very far for a host here at Showbiz Sandbox.
Well, I hope there'll be auditions. And will you increase the salary to try and lure some talent? Will Joe be able to make more than I did?
Yeah, by about 100%. Maybe, you know what? Make it 110%.
Times zero. Well, thanks for writing in, Joe. Hopefully I will be moving on. I hope I can do Jeopardy and the podcast at the same time. You know, game shows, as I'm sure you know, they record them all in like a couple months. They do a whole season's worth in like 12 weeks. You know,
they record
like
five
shows a day at least. Yeah, there's no reason not to. You know, you can churn them out. So I think the host just gets tired. That's the only reason. You can't do more. You know, you got to be on your game and do a good job. Well, seriously, no, you know, you got to be all the little details and things and pronunciations and stuff. So getting people in and out. 5 a day is probably the max, but you know, so I'm hoping I can do both, but you know, if not, I welcome you and look forward to hearing what the show will be like with a new co-host. I wasn't the first co-host. I won't be the last.
Well, you know what? We appreciate Joe writing into us. You can write into us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. In fact, that is where you can find ways to subscribe to us in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, your favorite podcast aggregator. That's where you can find us. And please do rate and review us in those podcast aggregators. It helps us out when you do. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The links that you to all the news stories that we discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. It's where you'll find ways to follow us. At showbizsandbox is our Twitter handle, and facebook.com/showbizsandbox is where you can like our page. Now, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website. It is whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found online, and every week he's got a new and exciting website. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's I really do want to host Jeopardy.com.
Actually, that is true. That may not be taken as a domain name. So, but here's the thing. If you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry on that website, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.